This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ranchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Health Grounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you in this, I have to say, spring-like Saturday morning, October 28th, 2023. You can't help but think that maybe this is the last of it, so let's get out and enjoy this weather, and hopefully people will get out and do some walking or some other outside activity. This morning, I actually got out to a football game, the junior varsity game at Hall High School down the street. A patient of mine was coming back from a concussion, and this was his first game back, so I did want to catch part of it. And it was great to be out on the field. I think that's probably the best part of my job, is to be out on the field and watching athletes and watching how they perform, and especially knowing where they've been when they've rehabilitated from an injury. And I think most physicians who do what I do and are involved in sports medicine in general really enjoy that. I've had an opportunity this week really to talk to several listeners, and in one of them, his point, he thought what he liked best about the show is when I talk about sports and things that happen in sports and sports safety. And I think that I appreciate that. I appreciate that feedback. I always like talking to people who are interested and regular listeners and have ideas. And I think that what he did was give me a good opportunity now to really talk a little bit about when you're out watching a football game, as I was this morning. There are things that you could do as a parent, as an observer, to help to some degree, especially in the lower levels, the Pop Warner, youth football, flag football levels. And people always ask me, how do you know when you're so far away from the action, whether it be on the sideline or at ringside, how do you know when someone may have suffered a head injury? So there are three things we look for. The first is, after a hit, is it taking a long time for the athlete to get up from the ground, longer than usual? The second thing is, does the athlete need some help getting up? And the third thing is, and the most important is, always look at their footwork. So in boxing, after someone is hit pretty hard, and I suspect a brain injury, I'm looking at their feet, the so-called flat-footed appearance, where they're not able to dance and coordinate their feet well. Because if they can't coordinate their feet in boxing, they also can't coordinate their hands. So it's the same in football or soccer or field hockey. If you suspect someone may be injured, look at their feet. If they stagger, if they're having a little trouble just getting their bearings on the field, tell somebody, because it's important to get them off the field. And tonight I'll be at Mohegan Sun for AEW Wrestling. This is an interesting group. It's the first time I've worked with this group. I've worked with WWE in the past, and this is kind of an offshoot of that. Some of their wrestlers have gone a different way artistically, and I know that one of the wrestlers was on with Brian yesterday, and it was a great interview by Matt Sirois, really talking about wrestling in general and this particular show. So if you're out there, you see me, come on down and say hello. Love chatting it up with folks. This day in medicine, October 28th, 1858, Dr. Henry Koplik was born. He was an American physician, a pediatrician, and he isolated the bacillus for whooping cough, Bordetella pertussis, so what we call pertussis. And whooping cough does have a vaccine, right? We all get that as part of our DPT. Naturally, there are now this trend of people thinking they don't need this vaccination or their children don't need it, but you do. So typically, DPT is diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus. And you should be getting a tetanus shot every 10 years. At the same time, you do get a pertussis shot. And whooping cough is typically not deadly in an adult. It's an upper respiratory infection. And what's important about it is it's easily transmitted. It's particularly dangerous for infants and young children. And it's given the name of whooping cough because when someone inhales who's having a bout of whooping cough, you'll hear that distinctive whoop type of sound. So again, vaccination is important. It's one of those things that really is almost wiped out from that standpoint. But I think we're starting to see more and more of it again. COVID hospitalizations. I promised I'd keep everybody up to speed on that. Over the past 7 days here in Connecticut, our hospitalizations that are in any way related to COVID are down by 18%. When we look back over the past 14 days, we are up about 6%. And that's really at the lower end of the spectrum, although nationwide, our hospitalizations are fairly low. The bivalent booster, the one we've been waiting for this season, is now available and readily available. I know because the pharmacies that canceled my appointments before are now getting back to me and saying they have it. So, and also they're working on a vaccine that will have both the flu in it, both the flu vaccine and the COVID vaccine every year with one shot. I want to get to a question that came up this week. A listener reached out to me. Last week's guest was Dr. Joy Antonelle DeMarchita, and she is from Hartford Hospital and is the medical director of the Chase Family Movement Disorder Center. Well, anyhow, a listener came up with a question about a relative who has a severely clenched fist and has been diagnosed with a contracture in that hand. Now, contractures such as this, where you see the hand clenched, are often seen in people who have had an upper motor neuron problem, whether it be a stroke, a tumor, and you could see it with dementia. So again, you'll see this clenched hand. So the question was, would Botox help this? And previously, they did try Xiaflex. Xiaflex is a medication that's injected into the hand, typically used for Dupuytren's contractures, where you see those in people who use their hands a great deal, affecting typically the fourth and fifth digits of the hand. So they had tried the Xiaflex and that didn't work. And the question was, would botulinum toxin injections work? So I reached out to Dr. DeMarchita and she did get back to me. And the answer is, if the limb can still be extended to full extension, then the Botox injections along with PTOT and bracing would help. If the person can in no way straighten those digits back to their full extension, then botulinum toxin would not be helpful, and the only solution for that would be a surgical one. So I hope that answers the question, and I thank you for that because it's something I had not thought about. And we deal with contractures and movement disorders all the time in a variety of patients. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest today. I want to talk a little bit about my guest. My guest is going to be Dr. Salvatore Napoli. Dr. Napoli is director of the Neurology Center of New England, and this is a huge practice in Foxborough, Massachusetts, that he really founded and developed. to the point where they have multiple neurologists. Now, Dr. Napoli's area of expertise is demyelinating diseases, the most common of which is multiple sclerosis. And I really want to get him on because so much has changed in the field of multiple sclerosis. As a neurologist, there are so many medications, there are infusions, there are pills, there are things that help the symptoms as well as arrest the progression of the disease. So not just slow it, but arrest the progression. And there are different types of multiple sclerosis. So you know how everybody, once you hear the words multiple sclerosis, you think, I'm going to be in a wheelchair the rest of my life. And that's just not the case. And I really want to talk about that in depth with Dr. Napoli. As always, if you have questions during today's show, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. And when you reach me, if the question is appropriate for my guest, I'll get that on. If you have questions during the week, as did another listener, I will be happy to get that to the expert in that field. Once again, you're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce my guest today, Dr. Salvatore Napoli. Dr. Napoli, as I mentioned, is director and founder of the Neurology Center of New England. He is a board-certified neurologist with a specialty in demyelinating diseases and did his fellowship at Brigham and Women's in Boston, and that's when I first became familiar with him and his great work, and he has been a great resource for me and my family. Sal, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Anthony. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, let's get right into it. Talk about, first of all, what attracted you to going into the field of demyelinating diseases? Talk about kind of your history of developing your interest here.
Yeah, so I trained at Albany Medical College, and just like anything else, it was mentorship and establishing relationships. And during residency, I really enjoyed seeing the MS patient. Every patient was different. They may have had different issues, different symptoms, some mild, moderate, or severe. But I really enjoyed establishing relationships with the patients and doing everything we could to stabilize them, give them hope. And then at the time, interferon therapy came out, and you know that therapy altered the natural history of the condition. So I really went to that field because you know these new therapies were coming out that would alter the natural history. So I decided to go in MS, and just like everything else, it was all about mentorship. I had mentors that helped to train me and encourage me to go into the field, and that's how I got to the Brigham with Dr. Howard Weiner. And trained under him.
Sal, let's take a step back. What are demyelinating diseases? You already mentioned MS, and that's the one we're most familiar with. But can you talk about them in general and maybe some of the other names people would be familiar with?
Absolutely. So MS is demyelinating diseases are a spectrum of conditions in the central nervous system. And by central nervous system, it's basically the optic nerves, the brain, and the spinal cord. And they're basically autoimmune conditions of the central nervous system. And the way I like to describe it to patients, it's as if the immune system, which is the military of your body, gets confused and creates inflammation in areas where it shouldn't. It doesn't mean that your immune system doesn't work well. It just gets confused. Imagine if you have 100 military members fighting the battle against viruses, bacteria, tumor growth, you have two or three members of that military, the 100 military members that get a little bit confused and create friendly fire in your own tissue. And that tissue is like the optic nerves, the brain, and the spinal cord. And what creates that inflammation, that's what causes the symptoms. MS is the most common form of demyelinating disease, but you have less common disorders like NMO or neuromyelitis optica and MOG antibody syndrome, where the etiology, management, and treatment might be a little bit different.
Sal, I guess one of the things that people always associate with multiple sclerosis is this horrible outcome. I mentioned that at the beginning of the show. And really, I guess when I started in neurology, you know, and you have to understand, back when I started, we had steroids. We actually used Cytoxan in patients, and that was about it. And I guess back then it was, we used to say about a third of our patients became severely incapacitated. A third were, you know, impaired to a large degree, and another third were still able to function and go to work and things such as that. How has that changed? Because everybody thinks right away that they're going to be at the worst end of the spectrum.
No, Anthony, it's amazing because we've kind of lived it kind of together over the past 20 years with this the explosion of new therapies that have come out. And I think you hit the nail right on the head. I think patients who get diagnosed with MS should really have hope because, you know, the advent of these new therapies, the research has really helped make the condition curative. So if you've been diagnosed with MS, especially if you're diagnosed early, you should have a lot of hope because a lot of things we do is curative. So we should be able to kind of shut down the condition and prevent relapses, prevent disability over time. I like to tell my patients, we want to get you to your retirement the way you should be. And it starts, you know, the earlier, the better. But I really think patients who have the diagnosis of MS, they should really be hopeful that, you know, establish a good relationship with your doctor. We can put you on great therapy that's effective, that's safe, and you can do all the things that you've ever wanted to do in your life going forward, having a family, doing the jobs that you want to do, you know, being active and physical. And like I said, get you to your retirement the way you should be. And I think there's a lot of hope, you know, given the explosion of things that have happened over the past 20 years. And, you know, you and I have lived it, and it's been amazing.
Sal, we'll get into MS a little bit more, but you already mentioned a condition called neuromyelitis optica. Can you briefly talk about that? Because I think that's one of the things, for some reason, I don't know if we're recognizing it more, or there's more of it out there, but can you talk a little bit about that condition?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a little bit less common. Again, it's rare. It's a rare autoimmune disease that affects the central nervous system. And again, it mainly targets the optic nerves and the spinal cord. You can have it affect the brain in some ways. The symptoms can be similar, but it's a little bit more severe as far as how it presents itself. But the good news is there's been a lot of research and new treatment options for they call it NMOSD. So there's a lot of research and actually three FDA-approved therapies that target that condition in particular. So if we can catch that early, again, we can alter the natural history of that condition as well. You know, some of the symptoms you may get with NMOSD might be optic neuritis, which includes loss or blurring of vision, loss of color vision. You may have inflammation of the spinal cord, which is transverse myelitis, which would include loss of muscle function, weakness, numbness. But again, if we can catch that early, we should be able to prevent things from getting worse. It's rare, a more different form of demyelinating disease, not multiple sclerosis, which is more common, but we do see it on occasion.
What's the most common symptom someone presents with a demyelinating disease? I know it used to be optic neuritis and visual loss. Is it still that, or are we seeing other symptoms coming to the foreground early?
That's a great question, Tony. I mean, when you look at the list of symptoms that MS patients have, it can be quite a bit. But, you know, a common symptom that many MS patients get are fatigue. So some patients may get fatigue. They feel this overwhelming sense of fatigue, and not the fatigue that you get like at the end of the day, more when you wake up at 9 in the morning and you still feel like you could use another 8 hours of sleep. Some demyelinating disease or MS patients may have optic neuritis, which is blurriness of vision in the eye. And usually the relapses aren't symptoms that kind of come and go 10 to 15 seconds at a time. These are sustained symptoms that you'll have over hours, days to weeks. Other symptoms that patients may have include numbness of a limb that travels up, say, starting in your foot, going up your leg, into your abdomen, and that's kind of a form of transverse myelitis. Again, these symptoms last days to weeks. I know a lot of patients may have numbness that occurs day in, day out, but this is a sustained different kind of numbness. Some patients may experience limb weakness as well. They may have fatigability of their leg, where they have some weakness or fatigability with prolonged distances. Their leg may feel like it's drooping a little bit, and that can occur either acutely or over time. Some MS patients may also have bladder and bowel symptoms. They may have frequency urgency. The other symptom that many MS patients may get is also cognitive issues. And it could be a little bit more subtle, not necessarily a fluid dementia, but, you know, just difficulty with word finding, attentional issues, things like that. And that can be a little bit more subtle in the MS patient.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to talk a little bit more about demyelinating disease and specifically multiple sclerosis. I want to get into the different types of multiple sclerosis, and we really want to focus on some of the treatments that we briefly mentioned already. If you need to reach out to me with a question, you could reach me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Back on Healthy Grounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. My guest today is Dr. Salvatore Napoli. Dr. Napoli is director of the Neurology Center of New England, and it is a phenomenal practice that he has there with many neurologists and support staff, and he specializes in multiple sclerosis. If you wish to reach out to Dr. Napoli, the phone number is area code 781-551-5812. Sal, I want to get into a little bit of the demographics here in terms of multiple sclerosis. So who do we see it in terms of age groups, sex, and things such as that?
Yeah, great question, Anthony. So, you know, usually it's multiple sclerosis. We estimate that there's about 1 million people in the country that have it. It's funny that when I tell people what I do, it always seems like someone knows someone that has it, whether it's, oh, my mailman has it or my cousin has it. So when I first started doing it, it seemed to be more prevalent. But we estimate that it's about 1 million people that have it. It is female predominant, and the most common form of MS is relapsing-remitting form of MS, relapsing-remitting MS, where patients will have kind of discrete symptoms or discrete relapses that kind of come and go over hours, days to weeks, and then slowly get better. And we think that after each exacerbation, you may not recover. You may recover, but might be 80%, 90%. Some people recover 100%, but we want to prevent those relapses so you don't sustain any disability. Almost like being in a boxing ring, Tony, you know, the more hits you take, the more disability you may accumulate. So we want to kind of prevent relapses from accumulating, but that overall, it's female predominant, but we certainly have male patients that have it. And there's a broad spectrum of patients that can get it, crossing, you know, multiple different people. And we kind of treat, how they present, you know, as far as, their relapses. They have a lot of relapses up front. Do they have a lot of activity up front? And that might change how we treat them.
Is it still more common in young people, or are we seeing it more in an older population as well?
Another great question, Tony. The range we say is from 20 to, you know, 40 or 50, but certainly, you know, we see patients in the pediatric population. So there's pediatric MS centers that have propped up. So the clinical symptoms may actually occur in the pediatric population as well, and they have targeted centers. And I really do feel like some of my patients, maybe in their 20s or 30s, they've probably had MS in a subtle form even when they were teenagers, but didn't maybe realize it. I've also had patients who've had the condition maybe longer than they think, and they get diagnosed at, you know, 40 or, you know, at 40, 50 years old, some even older than that, and may have lived with it longer than they think, but clinically it didn't kind of come out until that, you know, until that age. So that's what makes the condition so, you know, interesting to treat, is because everyone that comes into the office is different.
Do you see more MS at northern latitudes? When I was training at the University of Michigan, I used to think that we saw more of it there, and it was not by coincidence that most of the MS centers were in Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, as opposed to Florida and Arizona. Is that still hold true, that we see it more at more northern latitudes?
You know, definitely. And there might be a few different reasons for that. You know, northern latitudes, some people say, well, the sun exposure has something to do with it, or vitamin D exposure. But I think at the end of the day, it really is kind of the centerpiece of it all is genetics. So by northern latitudes, you're 110% correct on that. It's really northern European ancestry or northern European genetics. So if you have northern European genetics, that may make you more prone to autoimmune conditions. By northern latitude, I think it's even more about northern European genetics, which may make you more prone to certain autoimmune conditions. And typically in the office, when I see an MS patient, I'd like to ask them, hey, do you have any other family member that has any other autoimmune condition, like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease? That might give me a clue that, you know, this patient may have a predisposition to autoimmunity.
So I guess the $64,000 question people are asking themselves right now, as our listeners are thinking, what could you do to avoid MS? I mean, obviously, you can't change your genetics, okay? But is there something you can do, either from your diet? Does it have to do with exercise? What is it that you can do, either when you're young, middle-aged, or older, to avoid getting MS?
You know, great question, because I thought about that a lot. Like, is there a way we can avoid it? Is there a way? And I really think at the end of the day, you know, I think lifestyle is huge, you know, and I think, you know, taking care of yourself, doing the right things as far as exercise and walking, good diet, sleep is very important. And a lot of the MS patients I see who come in with an acute issue, honestly, there's always a setting of stress that seems to surround that new exacerbation, whether it's a stressful work situation or a stressful situation at work, stressful family situation. Stress seems to, I believe, trigger the immune system. So if you can keep that, you know, we have the treatments for MS, like that's 50% of it. But if you can have a great lifestyle, you know, sleep being a centerpiece, stress reduction, you know, continued exercise. I like to tell my patients, do your 7,000 to 10,000 steps a day if you can. If you can lead a good lifestyle, you know, integrating those things, you should be in good shape as far as prevention as well.
Sal, I have a question that just came in. And the question was, if you suffer repeated trauma, such as in football or boxing, or you have a traumatic event, a car accident, does that leave you more prone to developing multiple sclerosis? And this is an old argument, you know, the old trauma related, somebody got into an accident or fell down a flight of stairs, developed MS, and that was the cause. Is there any truth to that?
As far as the recent studies, I would say no. So, you know, trauma, concussion, there's no data at this point that says that it increases your likelihood of getting MS. I still think it's the genetic predisposition to it. And by genetics, I don't mean, you know, if you have it doesn't mean your child's going to have it.
Sure.
But I still think it's more of a genetic predisposition. So at this point, there's been no studies that have suggested that. I know it's being actively studied.
So, Sal, walk me through this. When someone comes to see you at the Neurology Center of New England with suspected MS, what does the workup consist of? I know it's an MRI, but does it include lumbar puncture, evoke potentials, blood work? Well, how do you work somebody up? What could they expect?
Yeah. So, Tony, when the patient comes into our office, we're a big believer in, you know, establishing that relationship. So really up front, we get staff members. We want to make patients feel comfortable when they come in and know that we're there to care for them. And we understand it's a difficult time when they're thinking, oh, my God, what condition is this? What am I dealing with? What are these new neurologic symptoms? It can be scary. So really the treatment and the diagnosis and every kind of starts up front with our staff. You know, when we see them in the room, you know, you know, the first step is, I think, listening to the patient, you know, and listening to their history. I get a lot from the first 10 minutes of the office visit, you know, listening to their history, listening to their story. And at that point, when I get that story, I'm able to kind of tell what direction this is going to go. I'm like, oh, this definitely sounds like MS, or I'm not really quite sure what this is. So the story and the history is so important. So you know, clinical history is important. Then, you know, physical exam is very important as well. We'll detect if there's any issues with vision, color desaturation. Do we detect any asymmetric weakness or sensory issues? You know, do they have a discrete numbness in their legs? We'll check their reflexes for upper motor neuron signs. And like you had alluded to before, I had been listening with the concussion aspect, the walking. We love to watch people walk and assess if they have a swinging type gait that might mean they have weakness in one leg. So the exam's an important part. And what's really revolutionized MS is MRI. So MRI, we're able to diagnose patients based on MRI. We're able to manage patients based on MRI. It's really revolutionized the diagnosis of MS. You know, on MRI, you know, a lot of patients, when they get an MRI, they may see spots on their MRI, and that doesn't necessarily mean they have MS. You know, you can get spots on from people have migraine headache or high blood pressure. But with MS, there's discrete lesions that you would see that kind of look like MS. So MRI has really revolutionized. And for those borderline patients that we're not sure, that's when we might do the spinal tap. And the spinal tap or lumbar puncture will help us assess if there's signs of neuroinflammation going on. And that's when we'll check for something called oligoclonal bands, which are kind of antibody formation in the spinal fluid. So for those borderline patients, or we're not 100% sure, that's when we'll do the spinal tap. But MRI has really helped revolutionize things, along with the clinical history.
Has it confused things as well? And I say that from the standpoint that I think a lot of patients had MS and kind of took it to the grave with them until we had the MRI. Because now we're seeing these lesions that don't really even have clinical significance. They got an MRI for another reason, and now we're seeing this. Can you explain what to do in that situation where the patient doesn't have a complaint that necessarily speaks to the diagnosis of MS, but now has lesions on their MRI? What do you do from that standpoint?
Yeah, we get that consult a lot. You know, the primary care doctor will get an MRI because, you know, someone will have a concussion and all of a sudden there's spots, or there's they call them T2 hyperintensities. And, you know, these are, you know, spots on the brain that for a lot of people over time, it could just be normal aging. You know, you can get these normal spots from normal aging over time. You can get them from migraine headache, from high blood pressure, and it might just be normal aging. But there is a differentiating factor with MS, where there's discrete lesions in certain areas of the brain that kind of look like MS. The morphology of the lesion may look like MS. The size of the lesion may look like MS. And these are what these lesions are, is they're actually scars. They're, you know, when the brain, when there's inflammation happening in the brain, it creates a scar. And you know, some people can live with it because, you know, the brain is a big organ, and it has a lot of, there's a lot of tissue there, and some areas of the brain can pick up the slack where other areas of the brain were damaged. Now, you bring up a great point. There are some patients, rarely, where actually more common than you think, that we run into it in the office, where they'll get a concussion, for example, an MRI is done, and wow, there's lesions that actually do look like MS. And that's called radiologically isolated syndrome. And we might be able to actually catch patients incidentally who have radiologic signs of MS really at its earliest time point because, you know, they got an MRI incidentally because for another issue. It could be migraine headache or concussion. So that does occur from time to time in the office, and we'll get that consult.
You talked a little bit about chronic progressive, you talked about relapsing and remitting MS, but can you talk a little bit about chronic progressive multiple sclerosis?
Yeah, there's different kind of subcategories that we use for MS. There's, you know, actually radiologically isolated syndrome is considered a category that we use. There's also clinically isolated syndrome, where someone has an initial event, but they don't quite fit the kind of McDonald with the official criteria for MS. Then there's relapsing remitting MS, where they have changes over time and space that, you know, kind of they definitely have the diagnosis of MS. Then if you've sustained multiple hits, so to speak, or relapses where you acquire disability, then we believe you may enter a different phase called secondary progressive MS, where you may have very slow disability accumulation over time. But, you know, I don't necessarily like to box people into a certain subgroup or category. I like to really individualize treatment. And I'll get to that as well. But
that's so important. Honestly.
Yeah.
That this pigeonholing thing just ends up handicapping you. So I'm so glad to hear you say that.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think these different and the other two categories, you know, primary progressive MS and progressive relapsing MS, you know, we use those terms. You know, primary progressive is kind of a slow disability accumulation over time, where, you know, some people, you know, maybe male patients, African American patients, where they present a little bit more aggressively, they may have more spinal cord disease, but you know, we use those boxes, so to speak, really for research studies. Do I actually use it myself in clinical practice? No, because I really like to individualize the patient, and I don't like to box them into a certain group, because I see it as an individualized disease, and we treat it as such. And I think the care is better when you do it like that, and I think how you manage the patient is better like that as well.
A question just came in, Sal, and you mentioned a little bit about vitamin D, but the question is, does vitamin D supplementation either help you avoid MS, or do you use it in the treatment of MS?
Yeah, so vitamin D, you know, a lot of patients ask about, hey, what's the one supplement that might work? And there's actually good data, you know, over the past 5 to 10 years that has shown that vitamin D actually has positive immunologic effects, regulatory effects on the immune system, which may help. So, you know, typically, you know, a lot of patients will say for a vitamin D level, if you check a vitamin D blood test, you know, for the patient who doesn't have MS, usually they'll say, hey, 30 is a great level. For my MS patients, I like to supplement it a little bit more and have their level between 40 and 60. So it's not uncommon for my MS patients to be on a daily vitamin D supplement. They'll have vitamin D maybe 2,000 units a day. Some patients may need 5,000 units a day. And we'll tend to check it at least every 6 months. And obviously, it depends on the season. If you're in the Northeast, you might need a little bit more during the winter months. But we do believe that's the one supplement that there may actually be some positive immunologic effects. And again, we might have them at a different level compared to the non-MS patient.
Let's talk a little bit about treatment. You mentioned interferon. Can you walk us through a little bit about what are the current treatments that you're using for multiple sclerosis?
Yeah, Tony, it's been amazing. You know, I started 20 years ago where we had 3 or 4 therapies, and these were injectable therapies that we, you know, you and I both would use, interferon therapy, glatiramer acetate, and these were injectable therapies. And ever since, over the past 20 years, being in the middle of it now, we have over 25, 26 therapies now. And they're really tailored specific to the immune system with different mechanisms of action. So we have oral therapies that might be trafficking agents or may impact the immune system to kind of shut the disease down. There's also infusible therapies that may deplete those military members I talked about who like to create friendly fire. They're called B-cell depleting therapies, where they take away those autoimmune type friendly fire military members and replace them with more friendlier cells, so to speak. So those are B-cell depleting therapies. And a lot of those therapies, they might be every 6 months. There's injections that you can give monthly. So those are trafficking agents. Natalizumab is another trafficking agent that targets T cells, which is another member of that kind of autoimmune military member that blocks those agents from entering the central nervous system and causing autoimmune inflammation. It's been incredible. And utilizing these therapies and utilizing them, you know, at the earliest time point, if we can, really has impacted the natural history of the condition. And a lot of people ask, you know, do we have a cure for MS? And I think in some ways what we've done is curative. we're able to impact the natural history of the disease so people can live the lives they've always dreamed of and get to their retirement the way they've always dreamed of. And I think, using these therapies along with the lifestyle things we talked about before really can really impact in a positive way a patient that has MS.
Sal, in our last minute, what's the one message you'd like to get across to people who have MS or know somebody who has MS right now?
Definitely have hope. You can live with the condition. You can partner with your neurologist. You can be hopeful that you can live the life you've wanted to live. Irregardless, and our motto, we like to treat patients as if they're members of our own family. But really is it's to make MS boring. We like to get you to the point where you're not even thinking about the condition. And I think we've gotten to that point for a large majority of patients. And for those patients who are struggling a little bit more, that's what we're here for at our center. We have a team of people. It's definitely not just me, but we have staff members, administrative staff, nurse practitioners, physical therapists, speech therapists, nurses, medical assistants, research people. That it takes a village to really help those patients that are struggling, and a great team approach. And we're here to help out for those struggles. And those struggles can occur, during settings of stress, and that's what we're here for as staff to help those patients. So, but definitely hope, be hopeful, to lead the life you've always dreamed of.
Sal, thank you. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for everything you do. I could vouch for the fact of every patient I've sent to you has had a great experience with your office staff and with your setup there. But on a personal note, I want to let you know what a great source of pride it's been for me to know you over these years and watch your career develop into one that has been a life of real service to patients with multiple sclerosis. Thanks for your time today, and thanks for all the great things that you do.
Anthony, thank you. And, I couldn't have done it without you and your mentorship as well. So, your advice and everything you've done to help me and to train me too. I really appreciate everything you've done. So, and thanks for everything you've done for everyone in Connecticut and in the New England region.
Thank you, Sal. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to wrap things up on Healthy Rounds. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Many thanks to our guest today, Dr. Salvatore Napoli. If you wish to reach out to Dr. Napoli, the phone number is 781-551-5812 for the Neurology Center of New England. His website is myneurodr.com. And if you missed any part of today's show, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast. Many thanks to Kevin Corza, who's been on the board for us today. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.